Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. In the wake of the worst natural disaster in the nation since Superstorm Sandy, flooding recovery efforts in Baton Rouge are now taking place. However, not nearly enough media attention is being paid to what is now by some being called the Forgotten Flood. With me to discuss is Danielle Bosson. She is the leader of our climate team here at CAP. You have a title. You have a real title. What is your real title, Danielle?
I like your title.
The great leader.
My actual title is Managing Director of Energy and Environment Policy.
A title I should be able to remember because that's my title for the poverty team. Well, Danielle, Managing Director Bosson, thank you for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you.
So just to kick things off, tell us a little bit about what happened in Baton Rouge. Give us the nuts and bolts. What caused this flood?
Well, there are a number of scientific reasons why this flooding occurred and why it was so terrible. So basically what happened is just unprecedented rain. And what some people are saying is that the ground in the Baton Rouge area actually served almost as the way an ocean does in building up a storm. So the moisture in the ground and the heat kept feeding into the weather pattern that was happening. So an unprecedented amount of rain just dumped and sat on top of almost a third of Louisiana parishes.
And it was 31 inches of rainfall, right, is what I've been hearing
from
some sources.
That's what I've heard as well, yep.
Which, to put that in context, is more than the average yearly rainfall that most places in this country get.
That's right. The National Weather Service called this a once-in-a-thousand-year weather event.
So why is it not receiving more attention, and why are some people calling it the Forgotten Flood?
Some people are calling it for the Forgotten Flood for several reasons. One, the media attention was directed elsewhere. Some say that the Olympics caused the media attention to be less. Other people are saying that because this wasn't a storm that had a catchy nickname, it wasn't a hurricane, people weren't as attuned to it, didn't make for a snazzy news story or title. Other people are saying that there's fatigue when it comes to these kinds of climate disasters, and particularly in Louisiana, which last year we remembered the 10-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Mm-hmm. And since then, there have been a number of other, not just climate issues, but civil unrest and civil justice issues, social justice issues that have been happening in Louisiana. And I think some are saying that there's a fatigue, which is obviously problematic and sad, given that there needs to be an incredible amount of attention, not just in Louisiana, but in all areas that are vulnerable to climate disasters, but also civil unrest.
What have the effects of the flood been? What has been the human toll that the storm has taken?
So right now, there are 12 people who lost their lives. That count, I'm not sure if that count's going to increase or not. There are 60,000 homes, last I checked, that have been affected by the flood. There are people who have lost just everything. I have not personally gone through a flood, but from what I'm reading, it's not just that water comes in and leaves. It renders your entire house uninhabitable. So what happens is mold begins to grow. You have to throw out everything. You have to cut out drywall. It's a complete and utter devastation of everything that people have worked so hard to build and own.
Part of what makes this storm so tragic in so many ways, apart from the fatigue that people are experiencing and the lack of attention that it's receiving, and is that many of the people who have been impacted are actually evacuees of the areas impacted by Hurricane Katrina. Tell us a little bit about who those people are and what it is like for them to be impacted not once but twice by a severe weather event like this.
Well, you know, I can't speak for the individuals, not being one of them, who was evacuated from Hurricane Katrina and then also was displaced by the Baton Rouge flooding. But I can tell you that when it came to Katrina evacuees, first of all, there was an unprecedented number of people who were evacuated after Katrina, about 1.5 million people from Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama combined within a 2-week period. And what happened is people discovered there was a large amount of research done about the evacuees that was highly unusual. And if I can interrupt myself for a moment, you know, we have severe weather severe weather and severe climate disruptions all the time, and people are evacuated or displaced on a yearly basis. You know, it doesn't take that much effort to do a Google search and look at flooding, whether it's coastal flooding or river flooding or drought or wildfires, and discover that there are all of these natural disasters that are causing people to leave their homes. What we don't have is a lot of research that shows where people go, how social services and other services have helped meet their needs. That is a little different when it comes to Hurricane Katrina. There was an effort by sociologists and by government agencies to track people in an effort to give them the services that they needed. And so in that one example, we have seen that people who perhaps unsurprisingly come from low-income communities have suffered the worst. So in terms of health impacts, the people in low-income communities tended to have worse health impacts before the storm, but then after the storm, getting their social services and health services met in new communities proved to be very difficult. Records were lost. There was a new bureaucracy to navigate. Homes, obviously, after a home was devastated, the housing stock itself became very limited. We're already seeing that in Baton Rouge. And then in host communities where people went, it became very difficult to find housing. Housing was very expensive. And that obviously takes a very difficult toll if you are not making a living wage. And so then there are also mental health studies that show that people who survived Hurricane Katrina and were relocated actually suffered higher amounts of depression than people who returned. The health impacts, PTSD, was prevalent and more prevalent in low-income communities. So I think it's safe to say that people who suffer this kind of climate disruption and climate displacement are also going to, from Baton Rouge, are going to experience similar effects, which is why it's so important when we talk about recovery and rebuilding to also talk about returning people, and not just people who own their homes, but people who were low income, who rented, who lived in subsidized housing. These are important communities that need to be returned for the economic safety of a community, but also the economic and health and well-being of low-income communities within larger parishes and towns.
Now, you write in a piece that you have up at talkpoverty.org this week describing the horrific toll that has been taken in Baton Rouge. You sort of explore the link between low-income communities and both greater vulnerability to severe weather events, as well as less in the way of climate resiliency. What is climate resiliency, and why are low-income communities so especially vulnerable?
Well, I'll start with describing just how low-income communities are vulnerable to climate events in general. So, as I mentioned before, low-income housing, whether it has deferred maintenance or is sited in a place that isn't geographically doesn't have the best geographic situation. So if it's a low-lying area or it's near an industrial community, these tend to be the places that people will put low-income housing or where housing values will be depressed. And so low-income communities often are situated in areas that just off the bat aren't necessarily built for climate resilience. In parts of New Orleans, I believe it is East New Orleans was a middle-income neighborhood, largely African-American, built on a filled-in swamp. And so what happened when the waters flooded was that that ground was not designed, that area was not designed, like areas of, say, Uptown were, to withstand the kind of floodwaters that occurred there. So you've got a situational difference. You've also got economic vulnerabilities in that people who have wage-based jobs after an event like this either may not be able to get to work or work may not be open, in which case you're losing wages either way. And then, as I mentioned before, the health impacts for low-income communities. It's proven that low-income communities usually suffer from higher rates of asthma and other health impacts associated with poor climate values. And then on top of that, you put, you know, lack of access to healthcare or worse outcomes after a climate event, like rates of depression and PTSD.
You write in your piece, and some of these numbers are incredibly staggering, that looking back at the areas that were impacted by Hurricane Katrina, you're looking at the parishes that are impacted by Baton Rouge. Let me get these numbers correct here as I'm quoting you. So untold thousands of Baton Rouge area residents have been affected by the flooding. We're not even entirely sure right now of the exact numbers. Of the 20 parishes that have been declared disaster areas, 17 of them have higher levels of poverty than the national average. Is this similar to what we saw in Hurricane Katrina?
You know, that's an excellent question, and I can't recall the poverty level in New Orleans proper, but I do think it's fairly safe to assume that the most impacted residents, as has widely been reported in the Ninth Ward or even in parts of East New Orleans, have been lower income communities, places where insurance wasn't always kept up with, and it may not have been needed because a home would have been owned by the same generations that had a cloudy title, things that made it very difficult for people to return. And then there's this catch-22 where if you have an entire low-income area that's been decimated, people want to return when they know other people are returning. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult sometimes to get that kind of communication between groups. But then businesses who operated in low-income communities also don't want to open if they don't know people are coming. And people don't want to come if they don't know if their businesses are going back open.
So sort of a chicken or an egg thing.
Absolutely.
That can become a vicious cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the status of the recovery? We're at a point now where electricity is now back on in some neighborhoods. Some of the damaged components of homes are being removed. Are we where we should be when it comes to recovery? Is assistance coming in the way that it needs to be?
This is going to be an incredibly long slog. And one of the reasons why, again, to come back to your beginning, why I think it's going to be called the Forgotten Flood going forward and not just in this one instance, is because it's a very long timeline for people to understand what their options are, to apply for flood relief, for programs to develop that can help people of all income levels return back into their homes. And so what is so important is not necessarily to say, you know, after day 15, where are we? Are we doing the right thing? But saying after 6 months, are people still aware of their options? Are people being able to come back home? Are we making repairs fast enough? Now, the silver lining, if there is one, is that after Hurricane Sandy, New York State, New Jersey State, and some city agencies developed programs that were designed to bring people back into their home as quickly as possible. And this is very important because so often the funding for this kind of relief follows the area and not the person. So if funding can go to making homes habitable as quickly as possible, even if it's not perfect, but it makes a home habitable, then you can bring people home and work on the repairs later, but not be spending money on putting people up in hotels or in trailers unless that's absolutely necessary. And so I think the better question is to say, are we going to be doing what we need to be doing 6 months from now, a year from now? Because we've seen through past events like this that it takes sometimes up to 3-4 years for somebody to actually have the ability to return back into their own home or their own neighborhood, which is just not how it should be.
And you mentioned some of the challenges that evacuees from Hurricane Katrina faced in returning home. In addition to needing to come back to something that is habitable, whether it is the house you were living in previously or another place that you can live, what are some of the challenges, both practical and policy related, that people who are returning home might face?
I think some of the challenges are knowing what's available, knowing what the programs are. There are websites that have that information available, but whether that information is available in someone's native language is always a concern. There are people who don't have the funds available to begin work on their homes, and so what kind of interim programs might be available to them. These are the kinds of things that that people need to start thinking about. And what's interesting is that we have seen in the wake of other natural disasters that community organizations have played a very important role in trying to help people with relief efforts, but also return efforts. And so what I would recommend is for not just for people to ask what their community groups are doing and try to touch base with community groups, but also for the federal government, other nonprofits to look at locally based community groups and see what kind of assistance they can offer, since they so often serve not just as a first responder for communities like this, but as a partner in making sure that a community is restored.
Another piece of what has made this particular tragic event so incredibly heartbreaking is how unprepared the people who lived in Baton Rouge were for this. Many didn't have flood insurance because they weren't living in a floodplain. It wasn't something they expected. They weren't required to have their houses on stilts, the kinds of things that if you live in an area that is likely to be impacted by flooding, people might do as precautions. What do you think is going to happen moving forward, not just in Baton Rouge, but perhaps in other communities to try to be more prepared, or is nothing going to happen at all?
Well, I don't want to say that nothing's going to happen at all, but I do think that because flood insurance is expensive and it wasn't required for so many of these homeowners, we are likely to see additional situations, not necessarily in Baton Rouge, but throughout the country, where people all of a sudden realize that they have a climate vulnerability that had never been mapped before or explained before. The federal insurance program, that people are going to have to take a long and hard look and see how the federal government can step in, or if the federal government can step in and help some of these homeowners, can help landlords, that people can get back into rental housing, can help build affordable housing so that people have a place to return to. I think that there are going to be there are a lot of places, though, that are they're at risk and may not even realize it and may not be able to afford flood insurance. And so, unfortunately, I think chances are that it's likely we'll see maybe not as flood that's this disastrous, but we'll see examples of this crop up in other places in the nation.
In the meantime, while rebuilding is going on, forgotten or otherwise, where are the evacuees from Baton Rouge going?
I haven't seen data on that. And again, this is pretty typical after an event like this. And it's relatively recent, so we don't necessarily know where people are going. There have been reports of people trying to go to their relatives' homes or other parishes, friends where that haven't been affected. There are stories of people who are trying to shelter in place and just sort of remove the health hazards from their home and stay in their homes as much as possible. It does point to, though, a need for the kind of data to see where people are going so that we can provide social services, we can provide other services, community groups can get involved and help people in their recovery, relief, and return efforts. And it also points to a larger need for us to prepare host communities so that, for example, after Katrina, you know, Houston took in I think it was half a million Katrina refugees, and then had to scramble for funds to figure out how they were going to absorb this large community into their schools and their systems and their housing. And so, so I think it points to the need to also have surrounding cities look at not just their climate vulnerability plans, but also their ability to take in the climate displaced if necessary.
And it is actually a very similar time of year as Hurricane Katrina occurred mm-hmm. back in 2005. It was back to school time. So obviously will be a huge impact, not just on the affected families and the kids who aren't going to be able to return to their same school districts if they've been displaced, but on surrounding areas as well. In the last couple of minutes that I have with you, I would love to hear about both some of the policy solutions that we would hope that policymakers would be turning to, both to prevent low-income communities from being especially vulnerable to future climate events, but also some of the resources that people who have been impacted might need to be aware of.
Sure. So I think in terms of building resilience in low-income communities and communities at large, mapping of climate vulnerability, not just present climate vulnerability, but anticipated climate vulnerability is going to be incredibly important. Making sure that homes and apartment buildings and other structures are built and buffered to withstand these anticipated climate impacts is going to be incredibly important. And I think one often overlooked aspect, as I mentioned, community organizations, is strengthening those kinds of social ties and community cohesion, because that's often what helps people survive extreme weather events like this, where people can, as the president said during a heat wave recently, where you can check on your neighbors and make sure people are okay and make sure people don't get left behind. In terms of resources, NOLA.com on their website has a list of places that people can donate supplies and funding to go help victims. But I would also ask that people just keep this event in their collective consciousness, because it will be a very long time before everyone is back home. And we should keep attention and pressure on the media and also on federal officials to make sure that people can go home. Everyone who wants to go home can go home.
Danielle Bosson is apparently the managing director of the climate and energy team here at the Center for American Progress. Thank you so much, Danielle, for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. Continuing today's discussion, we're going to switch gears and commemorate a particularly important anniversary. It's the 20th anniversary this week of the 1996 welfare law, which created a program called Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. That program replaced a previous New Deal era program called Aid to Families with Dependent Children. And with me to discuss the significance of this anniversary, what TANF is, what we've learned over the course of the last 20 years, and where we go from here is Indy Duddagupta. He's the director of the Project on Deep Poverty at the Georgetown Center on Poverty and Inequality. I think I butchered your title, Indy. Who are you really? Do we even know?
No, that's great, Rebecca. Thanks so much. I'm glad to be on here.
Wonderful. Well, we're glad to have you back. So take us back to 1996. What happened with that 1996 welfare law that we're talking about so much this month?
That's a great question, Rebecca. The 1996 welfare law actually had a fairly wide range of provisions, some of which were focused on converting the AFDC program, or Aid to Families with Dependent Children, into what's now the TANF program, or Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. And others had much broader repercussions. So, for example, the law included numerous restrictions on access to benefits for immigrants. It also affected the child welfare system, supplemental security income program for people with disabilities. When you think about the TANF in particular, there are a few main features, essentially, that really give you a flavor for what was changing here in the program. First, instead of having a program that essentially provided federal matching funds for states to help their most vulnerable children and families who were struggling in the labor market, it created a fixed level of funding through a block grant, which is essentially a term for a pot of money with lots of flexibility. And the law set that level, and that level has actually never been increased since then, despite significant changes in both population growth and just the growth of the need. The other thing that's really important here is the law really shifted the focus in many ways of the program to family formation, arguably much more so than the focus on employment and child well-being. I think the main things to keep in mind is the law essentially gave states large pots of money that they could have a lot of potential uses for, and for individuals and families in a way that wasn't the case before, they lost the same sort of guaranteed access to potential benefits. And I just want to be clear that when we think of what we call our welfare program, only a share of it is actually used for cash assistance, which is what many people actually have in their minds when they hear the word welfare. We can talk more about that here, but it's only a fraction of it that's really used for cash assistance, and there's a wide range of other uses, including things like marriage counseling, but also uses for the child welfare system or child care, even though we have other funding streams in many cases for these other programs.
So backing up just a quick second to an important two-word phrase that you mentioned just a couple of minutes back, block grant. So TANF operates as a block grant, which, as you mentioned, is flat funded. It receives the states receive the same $16.5 billion today that they received in 1996, and as a result, it's lost a lot of value. But help us understand how block grants work. What are maybe the pros and cons, particularly in light of the fact that there are lots of folks out there, particularly conservatives, who often like to point to block grants as something we should do to other programs.
So block grants are a way for the federal government to give states funds for stated purposes and to do so in a way that gives states varying degrees of flexibility, but by default, some substantial flexibility in how exactly states spend the funds. So if, for example, one wanted to make sure that certain services were delivered in ways that were holistic or integrated, you might think, hey, we don't want to specify exactly what to spend on these services, but here's a pot of money. You figure out for each person the best way to spend that money. The big challenge is that, one, states are often not held accountable to how they spend these funds on block grants. And two, many recent proposals in particular would undermine important funding streams that directly meet universal needs. So, for example, a proposal to block grant the SNAP program, formerly food stamps, makes very little sense. We know that everybody has these food and nutrition needs. And we know, if anything, we're underfunding the benefit relative to people's needs for their grocery budget every month. And so if you block grant something like that, you can almost certainly expect that you would see states using the funds for all sorts of other purposes. And the reality is, as much as policymakers may try to avoid it, states are enormously creative at finding ways to use funds to plug holes in their budget. They generally have balanced budget requirements. They don't like raising revenues any more than people do in Washington, maybe even less. And they will take every opportunity, as we've seen over the last 20 years of the 96 welfare laws experience so far, to use flexible funds to reduce their own funding. We've seen this, for example, in the case of childcare and TANF, and to plug holes in their budget, which in turn means that they can essentially even lower taxes. So the very real risk with funding like block grants and generally very flexible funding to states is you can, in fact, even reduce overall spending on the very people you're trying to help.
And we saw that play out in the recent Great Recession, right? Tell us a little bit about how TANF did as an anti-poverty tool and as a counter-cyclical tool or not in the recession.
There's really no better test, Rebecca, for whether or not a program is able to adjust and meet need as need changes than a recession, and especially one that was sufficiently deep and long as the Great Recession, which started in December 2007 and went through at least June 2009. And what was remarkable is that the TANF block grant, is despite some additional resources from Congress through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, or Recovery Act, still only barely budge in some states like Texas, despite the fact that the unemployment rate more than doubled, that need by almost any measure was increasing for children and families. Some states like Texas actually saw their TANF participation decline during this downturn, even as programs like SNAP, which are designed more to be an individual or family guarantee based on need, or programs like unemployment insurance, were wildly responsive and did a lot to lessen the devastation of this recession, which, of course, none of these families had anything to do with creating or contributing to.
I'm speaking with Indy Duttagupta. He leads deep poverty work at the Georgetown Center for Poverty and Inequality, and we're talking about TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, which was created 20 years ago and is commemorating that birthday this week. You also mentioned another key word, flexibility. Flexibility is a word that often gets thrown around, and again, particularly by conservatives, as a virtue and something that we want to shoot for in changing or, quote, reforming federal programs. We want to give states and locals all the flexibility that we can. Is TANF a flexible program in a positive way? Is the flexibility borne out? And does that, how do you see that fitting in, particularly with respect to how it functions as an employment program?
The TANF program is so unusually flexible that you should almost see it as 50 distinct state programs. That's not to take away at all from the federal role. But What we might have expected from that, from anyone who, you know, took a civics course even in high school, is great experimentation in these laboratories of democracy. And early on, in fact, even before the 96 welfare law, we saw some of that. And we learned some great things under waivers that the Clinton administration had continued before the 96 law came in. And sadly, what we've seen since then is virtually none of the lessons learned have been brought to scale, expanded, and replicated across states. And so that was the sort of really the hope in some ways of having this flexibility at the state level. But the other big challenge with flexibility without accountability is at the end of the day, you open yourself to you open yourself up to the whims of every state legislature and every governor. And the reality is that may be appropriate for certain things, but we're talking about people meeting their very basic human needs. And when people, we know exactly what people's very basic human needs are, you know, food, shelter, clothing, personal effects, and these are just the material needs. And you've got a situation now where while the old program never provided sufficient benefits that anyone would choose to and desire to live on long term, and no one could secure a decent life, the new program doesn't even offer benefits in a single state that's equivalent to fair market rent. And so what one would actually want if you wanted to give states the ability to experiment with employment programs and find ways to adapt to the changing labor market is have accountability, and both on making sure people get into the program. I think something that's often lost in conversations about the effectiveness of programs is a program is only as effective as it is in actually reaching people. So if no one signs up for, in some cases, you know, less than 10% of poor kids in some states are even participating in the program, it's not going to do much to help them. And now we have a situation where you might have thought that this flexibility would have helped, where the labor market has become increasingly harsh towards people with limited skills. The United States has an unusually high level of low-paying jobs that are unstable, that are incompatible, frankly, in many cases, with raising a family. And in fact, there are detailed rules and regulations in TANF, and states have made decisions anyway that do very little to prepare mostly single mothers who participate in the program for getting better jobs. Very little in the way of education and training and other workforce investments, never mind things like subsidized employment, which we've had a wonderful experience with recently when the federal government stepped in and offered huge sums of additional money during the Great Recession for. It's very frustrating for many people who observe this program to see how almost everything that could go wrong with flexibility has materialized and very little of what was hoped to go right has.
And indeed, despite the touting of so much flexibility around this program, and much of which is true to a fault, as you've pointed out, there also are many ways that states don't have the flexibility that they need, particularly with regard to how they help people prepare for work. One of the restrictions that has always struck me as incredibly counterproductive is when it comes to job search and job readiness training assistance. If you say you're a parent and you're looking for work and you need some help, maybe with your resume and getting you know prepared to start actually applying for jobs, states are not allowed to provide more than 4 consecutive weeks of that assistance and no more than 6 weeks in an entire year of that kind of help, even if the job search counselor thinks that that would be helpful, even if the person is looking incredibly hard for work.
That's absolutely right, Rebecca. And I think one of the things that everyone who cares about this issue should know is, on the one hand, there's a real case to be made that TANF does suffer from some serious and profound structural challenges. But on the other, it's also the case that even many of the small details have really become more of a barrier than a ladder for too many struggling parents. And a perfect example is what you've raised about the incredible specificity with which the program defines and counts people's participation in work and work preparation activities. The reality is there are some actual sort of ideological views that underpin aspects of the program that you can see not just in the structure, but right down to the details, like you said. And one of the ones that I think has most sort of poorly borne the test of history is the idea that any job as soon as possible is necessarily the best way forward for a struggling person, often with limited skills, with kids. What we've seen with changes in the labor market, with longer term evaluations of actual employment programs, is that we probably need to do a lot more investing in people's skills, training, and preparation for work. And it can make a very big difference to get somebody into a decent job rather than whatever the first job is.
So effectively forcing people into crappy, low-wage jobs that are not going to help them get ahead because they need to meet these work requirements.
Yeah, so essentially there's certainly a role for people to get something like subsidized jobs where there's serious oversight. You make sure it's a decent work site and workplace with good supervision. But just taking any job at minimum wage or around there when there's no future from that job to the – they're often not even stepping stones to the next job. And the way that workers are essentially in many of these positions disposable to their employers often means that the smallest thing leads to a layoff.
So in the last couple of minutes that I have with you, and we've talked about a lot of the shortcomings of this program, I want to put on my devil's advocate hat, which I so love to wear, and which I will wear in honor of Tracy because she often would wear it back when she was helping anchor this show, and we miss her already. So I'm a conservative who maybe touts TANF as a huge success. Maybe I'm celebrating this birthday, this 20th birthday of TANF, and I'm pointing to this program saying, isn't it a huge model? Because look, didn't it help all of these single moms go back to work in the 90s? Isn't it something that pushed people into the labor force and also dramatically reduced child poverty? Those are the claims that we hear. How do they measure up?
The most important factors based on the last 20 years of experience in reducing child poverty and increasing single mother employment are first, the economy. A program like TANF is hugely important and consequential for millions of people. In the case of TANF, including millions of people who don't access it, but could or should. Whenever you see poverty fall significantly in the United States, it is necessarily because you have widely shared economic prosperity and particularly the pursuit of ensuring that everyone who wants a job can have one. We've never really experienced truly full employment, in my judgment, even when the unemployment rate might be as low as 4%. Nationally, you have populations, especially communities of color, that experience unemployment rates double sometimes, that are still experiencing recession-like conditions. But that is the most important factor. The second most important factor in the case of the apparent improvement in child poverty and in single mothers' employment rates after the passage of the 96 law is really all the work supports and programs like the Earned Income Tax Credit, child care expansions, even the increase of the minimum wage. And I think that that's often lost in this debate, that this was happening, this 96 welfare law is happening in the context and sometimes very directly and explicitly with the idea that we would do a lot more to support working families. Because if you just do the math sometimes, you're often asking people to take employment that pays them less than the cost of quality childcare. And so we need income support, and that's according to the research, the EITC did far more than the 96 welfare law did to increase single mothers' employment. And reducing child poverty, we absolutely need to do. And the things that did the most there really, again, were the economy and these work supports. Now, let me just say broadly about this idea of TANF being a model. The idea of anything being a model is that you would replicate it, you would essentially take other programs in this case and make it like TANF. TANF reaches astonishingly few share of those who, frankly, not only are could be eligible, but who arguably are in need. That alone, to me, means that it simply cannot be a model for other programs.
Fewer than one in four poor families with kids.
And now here's the second point. We actually do have good models for programs that not only have shown incredible long-term impacts and meet families' needs in the short term, respond to recessions, and generally are well administered, but I think we have models from the tax credits for working families to the food stamp program or SNAP. Let me just take the food stamp program because I think it's such a stark contrast and there's a lot to learn from it really as a model. Here you have a program that in part because it's fairly simple, by and large, it helps people afford groceries and there's a monthly payment. And while states have some modest flexibility, a lot of the eligibility rules are set nationally. And the program not only responded rapidly and significantly in the recession, but it's also, as we're seeing right now, just as need has fallen, coming down as it's supposed to do. It is not one that has nearly the same stigma, or the hoops and the challenges and the hassle that TANF requires for people to participate in. And it can be a platform not just for giving people benefits, but to connect them with employment services and education and other opportunities for advancement. But let's just remember here, by and large, the food stamp program, it was expanded on a bipartisan basis over the last few decades. The research from its institution suggests that it had long-term gains for the children who are exposed to this new nationalized program, where they had much poorer health, much improved health and other positive outcomes when they're adults. And it looks like it might have limited hunger and food insecurity right after the passage of the Recovery Act, where we passed a significant increase. So here we do have a model, and it does give states some role. But the key thing is that there's accountability. It has a focused purpose. It has a focused benefit, where the money can only be spent on certain things. And it has a proven track record over a very long period. In fact, to the extent that the child poverty and other measures of well-being and hardship haven't worsened, especially over the last 15 years or so, the SNAP program is a major reason why.
Indy Didagupta leads deep poverty work at the Georgetown Center on Poverty and Inequality. Thank you so much, Indy, for joining the program to talk about one of our favorite acronyms, TANF.
Thank you, Rebecca. This was a lot of fun, and I hope one day I can try to wear the devil's advocate hat.
We should make one. That should be a thing that we make our guests wear.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. Continuing our commemoration of the 20th anniversary of the 1996 welfare law, which created Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or TANF, I have with me someone who is going to make the libertarian case for why TANF is broken and welfare reform is in need of reform. His name is Samuel Hammond. He is the poverty guru over at the Niskanen Center. Sam, thank you for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you.
So in addition to being one of my favorite libertarians, you also have one of the best Twitter handles that I am aware of. You are at Ham and Cheese.
Yeah.
Everyone should give him a follow on Twitter. But thank you for joining the show. And you contributed a piece to talkpoverty.org this week that makes the libertarian case against the 1996 welfare law. Tell me a little bit about where you're coming from. What is the libertarian case against TANF?
I think it goes back to the 80s, really, and the Reagan Revolution, when libertarians made a choice to ally with conservatives. And like so often when you're the minority, you end up being dragged along. And it was really a fusion that was formed around entitlement spending.
And a fusion between conservatives and libertarians.
Exactly. And it put other issues to the sidelines. So social conservatives are obviously within that tent. So in some ways, we've compromised on social issues as well. But when it came to libertarian strategy, we had this idea of starving the beast, which was just, let's cut government as much as possible and let the chips fall where they may. Unfortunately, because of the political economy of things, when cuts are on the table, the most expendable programs are often programs on the poor. And it's just a unfortunate metaphor, starving the beast, when there's actually people with food insecurity out there. So I've wanted to make the case or make the pitch that we have a lot of commonality on the left as well. I mean, the left has been pushing back on criminal justice reform, drug policy reform. And when it comes to TANF and welfare reform, it's progressive organizations that are talking about drug testing, welfare recipients, and why that is problematic. It's left organizations that are talking about bringing back more direct cash assistance so people have choice over how they want to spend their money. And, you know, part of, like, my classically liberal views are that the state should not impose preferences or impose values on your decision making. But when the libertarian movement allied with the conservative movement, they started treating welfare money as OPM or other people's money. Mm. And when you start thinking about transfers as other people's money, it becomes very easy to justify ordering people how they can spend the money by making things in kind rather than direct cash, by attaching work requirements. And I have nothing against work requirements, but the way TANF imposed them set up these just incredibly perverse incentives. And libertarians are great about talking about how government can often have government regulation often has like unintended consequences and doesn't work as intended. And I think TANF is just a great example of that. And yet there's very few people on my side of the aisle who are willing to say it.
And you mentioned drug testing of public assistance applicants and recipients. You mentioned work requirements. But another piece that you highlight of TANF and more broadly of public assistance programs in your column for Talk Poverty, which you argue is in conflict with libertarian and you also argue conservative values, is asset tests, mm-hmm. Which effectively operate as penalties on savings if right. you are seeking to apply for or receive public assistance such as TANF. Tell me a little bit about how that's in conflict with libertarian values.
Both libertarian and conservative values. I have another piece on the Niskanen Center website where I give three ways that TANF has failed conservative values. And a long-time conservative value is prudence. I mean, that's one of the cardinal virtues, right? prudence involves, you know, valuing saving, valuing thrift, but asset tests, which mean that your benefit gets cut off if you have more than $2,000 in savings, it forces you to spend down your money, spend down your assets to qualify for assistance when you're feeling desperate, and it makes it so you can't actually save up to do big life-changing things like move across the country.
And in many states, it's actually much less than $2,000.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it sounds reasonable on paper. You don't want someone who is cash poor but property rich, as they say, to be collecting welfare benefits. If you have $1 million property, you should sell the property or get a loan or something like that. But when the average American has less than $1,000 in savings, it's not a real issue. And same, it's sort of analogous to the drug testing thing, where drug test, like welfare recipients using their money to go spend on drugs and alcohol, is also just a myth. It's not an issue. You know, a lot of it makes me think of this Invisibilia episode. I don't know if you listen to that podcast.
I don't, no.
That's an NPR podcast, but they have an episode on I think he might have been Syrian, an immigrant to Denmark, and he was just a normal kid, but everyone there was sort of treating him like he was like a future terrorist, and then he ended up, because of that, like becoming recruited into ISIS, and then like coming back and like asking for forgiveness. But the point of the story was, in psychology, there's this thing called complementary and non-complementary behavior. If I treat you like a criminal, that leads you to internalizing, oh, maybe I am a criminal, or maybe I am a terrorist.
Becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Exactly. And so if poor people are having to test negative for drugs and they're just like regular people, not only is it like an affront to their dignity and like kind of insulting, but, you know, it does not have the... It does not send the right message. It sends the message that we don't trust them, and that can be counterproductive.
So progressives typically argue against bureaucratic disentitlement, as it were, whether it's the types of red tape that we've been discussing, this about drug testing or asset tests. Work requirements would fall into that category as well because of how difficult they can be to meet and how much paperwork and red tape they can set up. But conservatives, you would think, and libertarians it would follow as well, should see if they are holding views that are consistent with their principles, mm-hmm. Should see all of these types of policies as big government, as the nanny state.
Exactly.
Why don't they?
Well, it goes back to that other people's money issue, where it's this weird sort of double think. Like Representative Gwen Moore had that act that would have made that would have required a clean drug test for rich people to deduct more than $150,000 off their income taxes.
That's
or
right.
Something like that. People on the right do not recognize those kind of tax breaks and deductions as transfers. They feel like tax breaks to them. They feel like we're just getting my own money back. But that, like, analytically, that does not make sense. Mm-hmm. If you and I are the only two people in the country, and we're using public goods, and we are paying the same share of taxes, and then all of a sudden, I give you a tax break, but I don't. Like, that is a transfer from me to you, there's all this corporate welfare and welfare to the rich and upper middle class that we don't recognize as such, because it's hidden through the tax code. Whereas when we give money to the poor, it is very salient. You know, these transfers are very easy to see in the budget, very easy to target. And because of the way they're structured, they don't feel like you can't rationalize it as tax relief in the same way. But yeah, it is hypocritical, especially for libertarians. I have a series at the Niskanen Center called Overregulating the Poor, where I I go through examples of this, and but I'm an exception, so I know that, and I know many people out there in my camp who are thinking the same things. And libertarians have historically, fought against occupational licensing and fought against other forms of government-granted privilege, from like redlining, discriminatory zoning policies. All those things are progressive in the broad sense, but they're also sort of like supply side in the economic sense. So it just seems like there's a lot of room and a lot of opportunity for collaboration on these issues. But because of this fusion that I started off talking about, we've just let those opportunities slide.
So what do you see as the future of this narrative of the libertarian view when it comes to not just TANF, but more broadly public assistance programs or even social insurance programs? Do you think that this fusion is likely to break down and that you will not be alone in speaking out as a libertarian against these types of policies in a way that's consistent with libertarian principles?
Yeah, I think there's a shift going on. So back in 2006, Brink Lindsey, who was at the Cato Institute, he actually started off this conversation about fusionism and whether we should have a new fusionism. It's taken 10 years from 2006 to 2016, and we're still moving in that direction. We've seen successful partnerships on occupational licensing, on criminal justice reform. I think those proofs of concept, if you will, are going to motivate libertarians to think differently. Gary Johnson is an interesting case where he's been talking about Black Lives Matter, and he's been talking about discrimination in a way that you don't see from the Republican Party.
So in the last couple of minutes that I have with you, there's a particular line in your column at talkpoverty.org that I found particularly compelling. You argue that, quote, more generally, it's time to abandon the idea that safety net programs inevitably create dependency and damage markets. Whether through a basic income guarantee or a universal child allowance, the best evidence shows that robust safety nets can cut poverty while encouraging the kinds of risk-taking and entrepreneurship that lead to innovation, investment in human capital, and growth. Can you unpack that a little bit?
Sure. I think what I'm trying to say is just a myth that welfare necessarily creates dependency. You can have a program that's really poorly designed where it will, this is sort of where I like to start off. Conservatives will often talk about our great bankruptcy system. Our bankruptcy system lets people take risks, and if they fail, they don't become indentured servants, right? That is redistribution. That is redistributive policy. It redistributes from the people, the creditors, to the debtors. SNAP, EITC, a lot of these spending programs function in a similar way. There's research out of Harvard, because food stamps have increased, the spending has increased dramatically in the last 15 years, that using variation in the states has found states where SNAP has increased more, you've seen more business starts, you've seen more self-employment, you've seen people take risks, partly because they can go out and start a company, and if they fail, they are not starting, right? And this is something that other countries recognize. I'm not advocating moving towards Denmark or the social democracies, but they actually have freer markets based on the indices that libertarians like to put out, like the Freedom House Index and stuff like that. They regularly rank higher in terms of like low regulation and openness to trade and so on. I think one of the reasons is because people feel compensated. If you are open to globalization, which is a good thing, we should be engaged in the market, you're going to still have winners and losers. Mm-hmm. And if you have a system that compensates the losers from that, they're not going to have a populist backlash.
Well, this conversation is tempting me to start a series on the show called My Favorite Libertarian. We'll have to have you back. But in the last 30 seconds or a minute that I have with you, I think the main question that some of our listeners may be wondering, and which we haven't addressed yet, isn't flexibility and local control at the heart of what libertarian principles would argue for when it comes to program design, given that that is, to a fault, what TANF is premised on? How do you still see the program as broken?
I don't think TANF is premised on local control. Yes, they have block granted it and given states flexibility in how to spend it, but the work requirements and the rules are actually a step backwards in federalism. They're ordering states to impose these work participation rules. I like local government and self-governance. One thing that a lot of people on the left and the right don't recognize is that countries like Sweden that have very large welfare states, they are administered at a very local level. You know, healthcare and welfare is often administered at community level, county level, municipal levels. I like to say the U.S. has a reluctant welfare state because there's been so much there's been such a tug of war. We often end up with programs that are just compromised from the get-go. You know, receiving a check from a faraway bureaucracy is not ideal. you would rather have this money being channeled through civil society. But that's not what TANF did. TANF gave the states basically a stream of cash and wrote the rules such that they could spend it on things that had nothing to do with poverty. And did not promote civil society whatsoever.
Sam Hammond is the poverty guru, as I have named him, over at the Niskanen Center. You can find him on Twitter, at Ham and Cheese. Sam, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio, and we'll have to have you back soon.
Thanks again.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us weekends at 11 a.m. on the WEACT Radio Network. You can also catch us Saturdays, 11 a.m., and Sundays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Voices Network via the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And feel free to pitch us on Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org. See you next week.